Welcome to Victor's Children, a podcast from so-called Canada, talking socialism from below. My name is David Canfield. I live with my partner and cat in Winnipeg, Manitoba, which is in Treaty 1 territory, the traditional territory of Anishinaabeg, Cree, Ojibwe, Dakota, and Dene peoples, and the homeland of the Métis Nation. All those of us in the Canadian state who aren't Indigenous need to commit ourselves to the struggle against settler colonialism. Victor's Children is a member of the Harbinger Media Network, a community working to promote left podcasts in Canada. Check out the list of Harbinger podcasts at harbingermedianetwork.com. Is a break with capitalism and the start of a transition to socialism possible? As the Russian Marxist Leon Trotsky once wrote, for this to be true, it is necessary that among the antagonistic classes of capitalist society, there should be a social force which is interested, by virtue of its objective position, in the realization of socialism, and which is powerful enough to be able to overcome hostile interests and resistance in order to realize it. For the tradition of socialist politics for which Karl Marx was the founding theorist, the working class is that force with the interest and power to break with capitalism. So why has the working class so very rarely succeeded in making the kind of social revolution that would put it, and not some other force acting on its behalf, in power? Because of course, that's what's needed to open the door to a transition in the direction of a classless, stateless society of freedom. In other words, socialism or communism. Just as an aside for listeners, I'd like to point out that for Marx, socialism and communism referred to the same thing. The idea that socialism is a distinct kind of society, a stage on the path to communism, is an error with serious negative ramifications. This idea became influential among socialists through the doctrine of Marxism-Leninism that developed in the USSR in the 1920s, became the ideology of the new ruling class there, and was spread globally across the communist movement. So to get back to the question of why there have been so few revolutions that could open the door to a transition towards socialism, this episode is not going to tackle that big question. It's a huge question. We're just going to discuss one piece of the puzzle, which is how do we explain the low level of support for radical politics among workers in rich or advanced capitalist countries like the US, so-called Canada, the countries of Western Europe, Japan, and Australia? We'll also talk about a related issue, which is how to explain the often low level of militant action by workers in these countries. Now, today, some socialists explain the low level of support for radical politics in these countries with some version of an analysis developed by Lenin and fellow Bolshevik leader Zinoviev. They were both building on an idea of Frederick Engels that he had had about the British working class in the late 1800s. So these socialists say that a small minority of the working class in rich countries, which they call a labor aristocracy, is bribed with the loot that capitalists in rich countries get from imperialist domination of the global south. A few such socialists go further and argue that the entire working class in imperialist countries is bribed this way, and so it can't ever be a potentially revolutionary force at all. And there are also some other related ideas about how imperialism affects workers in imperialist countries. So the question is, how well do these ideas explain what they claim to explain? Joining me to discuss this and some related issues is Charlie Post. So Charlie, could you introduce yourself to listeners?
I'm in New York. I've been here for quite a while. I've been involved in the revolutionary socialist movement since the early 1970s. I also have done a fair amount of writing on the question of working class consciousness, origins of capitalism, and other related questions. And I've been teaching at the City University of New York for about 30 years now. And I'm currently a member of a small US-based revolutionary socialist network called the Tempest Collective.
Which I should mention to listeners of Victor's Children that I also recently joined, since it's now accepting members outside of the US. Okay, so Charlie, what were Lenin and Zinoviev trying to explain when they first came up with this kind of idea during the First World War?
All right, well, Lenin and Zinoviev, when they're writing, are trying to grapple with what for them was a completely unexpected development. For decades, all wings of the socialist movement internationally looked to what was the largest working class socialist party in the world, the German Social Democratic Party, known by its German initials SPD, as the model of a revolutionary workers' party. And the SPD, as the sort of main force in what was then the Second or Socialist International, had committed itself for decades to not only uncompromising struggle with their own ruling classes over every conceivable question facing working people in their particular country, but had also committed themselves time and time again at international conferences, et cetera, and the like, in opposing what almost everyone in the socialist movement in the early 20th century saw as an inevitable war between the various capitalist imperialist powers. Now, in August of 1914, that war breaks out. And completely to the surprise of many socialists, particularly in Russia, and particularly in the Bolshevik wing of the socialist movement in Russia, who had always looked to the SPD and its main theorist, Karol Kautsky, as the bedrock of revolutionary socialist politics, much to their surprise, the entire parliamentary delegation of the SPD in the German parliament, the Reichstag, voted to support the German war effort, voted for war credits, completely in opposition to the position that the party and the Socialist International had defended for for at least 15 years prior to 1914. This was extremely disorienting for the radical revolutionary wing of the socialist movement, not only in Russia, but throughout Europe and the world. And people were trying to come up, various Marxists were, the Bolsheviks in particular, but left-wing revolutionary socialists in Germany, throughout Europe, the US, elsewhere, were trying to do two things. One is to try to build and cohere a left anti-war, anti-imperialist wing of the socialist movement to try to rebuild the basis for international socialism after what they saw as the betrayal by the main socialist parties. Because it was not just the SPD, but almost every socialist party in the world, with the exception of the US Socialist Party and the Italian Socialist Party, all voted in favor of, to support their own ruling classes in this war. So they were trying to regroup those who resisted, were looking to resist the imperialist war, build an anti-war movement in their own countries, and in particular, they were trying to regroup those who saw that the struggle against the imperialist war would be the basis upon which revolutionary challenges to capitalist rule would take place, at least in a number of countries, Germany and Russia in particular. At the same time, as Marxists, they were trying to come up with an explanation of what happened. And Lenin and Zinoviev, because of their adherence to the SPD model and their embrace for most of the two decades prior to the First World War of Karol Kautsky as the major theorist of Marxism, did not have, I would argue, a very good sense of how the precursors to the 1914 capitulation on the war. There were revolutionary socialists in Germany, in particular around Rosa Luxemburg, who had seen the beginnings of the conservativization of the socialist part of the German social democracy as early as 1906, 1907, 1908. For Kautsky and Lenin and Zinoviev, the right wing, what was called the revisionist threat to revolutionary politics, had been vanquished by 1900 when the SPD and the International basically condemned the ideas of Edward Bernstein and others who openly proclaimed that capitalism could be reformed piecemeal into a new order. Luxemburg and others had already seen, particularly in the wake of the Russian Revolution of 1905, a growing conservativization of the German social democracy, particularly of that conservatization was being, its main force was the full-time officialdom of both the party, not just its first and foremost, its elected representatives, which they had in various regional parliaments, local governments, et cetera, a massive apparatus of people who worked full-time for the organization, putting out newspapers, organizing the party, et cetera, and particularly a growing conservatization of the ostensibly socialist leadership of the German trade unions. This comes to a head in Germany in 1910, 1911, in a debate about how to reform voting rights in the biggest German state, Prussia. The mainstream of the party, including Kautsky, basically argued the main thing is for us to win the next election and then change the electoral law through parliament. Luxembourg and others were saying, no, we've seen the example of Russia in 1905, the way the road to winning reforms, no less revolution, are mass strikes, mass working class action, which Kautsky rejected. Now, in that debate, which Lenin and Zinoviev were aware of, they actually sided with Kautsky. So for them, when Kautsky goes along with voting for war credits and takes, even when he takes a sort of mild anti-war position, which they describe as pacifist rather than revolutionary, they're trying to scramble to come up with an explanation. And the explanation they hit on is the explanation that goes back to Engels and which Kautsky himself had used to explain the emergence of the so-called revisionists, the first wave of reformist socialism in the early 20th century. And that is the notion of the labor aristocracy. The idea was there were these intellectuals who came from the middle class who never understood Marxism, and they found an audience among relatively privileged workers who accepted the existing society and existing state as the only possible form of state and society, and thus would be willing to support their own imperial power. They tried to update this by looking at what they saw as the formation of monopolies and the suppression of competition among capitalist firms within the nation state and globally, and the resulting what they called super profits accrued from imperialist investment in what we today would call the global south, or then would call the colonies and semi-colonies. So that's what they were trying to explain. They were trying to explain this huge and for them completely unexpected crisis of the socialist movement in 1914.
Right. So then were they right with their analysis of the labor aristocracy bribed by the super profits of imperialism as the explanation for the, you know, the real developments in the world that we're trying to explain?
Actually, I think no. Because in fact, even then, the percentage of total profits that capitalist firms accrued from their investments in the global south represented no more than maybe 15 or 20% of total profitability. And the profits from these investments accounted to no more than 2 or 3% of the total wage package for each of these countries. In addition, what they would see and had already seen in Russia and in Germany and there was a whole series, a big strike wave in between 1912 and 1914 throughout the industrialized capitalist world, from Japan, US and Canada, and Europe. And in those strikes, the most militant elements, the people who led the mass strikes and who were the ones who were attracted to the most radical socialist and anti-capitalist politics, were the best paid and usually the most skilled industrial workers, machinists, etc. This by 1914, at the time of the war breaks out, this is the bulk of the membership of the Bolshevik faction of the Russian socialist movement, and they would be the left wings of the socialist movements throughout Europe. So essentially, I would argue that both as a theory and in reality, the notion that the capitulation of social democracy to imperialism in the First World War was the result of a significant section of the working class being bribed with higher wages, better security, etc., just didn't make sense then and makes little or no sense today.
Well, let's talk about today then. So, of course, this idea about labor aristocracy is influential among some socialists because of the fact that it's there in Lenin's pamphlet on imperialism, which unfortunately over a century later, people still take as a starting point for understanding imperialism in the world today. But can we identify a distinct minority of the working class in imperialist countries that enjoys higher wages because of the profits that multinationals make in imperialized countries?
No, you can't. I mean, the calculations I've done, which overestimate, I mean, first of all, it is difficult to measure the percentage of profits made by transnational corporations in the global South, mainly because the data we have only distinguishes between profits made domestically and profits made through foreign direct investment. Now, most foreign direct investment, counter to what Lenin and Bukharin thought, in the early 20th century, and certainly is true today, never, most foreign direct investment does not go from the global north to the global south. Something like 80% of investment stays within the country of origin, and of the 20% that goes abroad, up until the rise of China in the last 20 years, three quarters of that investment went from one imperialist country to another. In other words, when the US corporations invest abroad, they're mostly investing in Canada, Western Europe, and Japan, not in, and today, in, to some extent in China, they're not investing in Latin America, most of Latin America, most of Africa, most of Asia. Okay. So there's the, so when I did my calculations for the period, basically from the end of the Second World War until about 2007, 2008, I overestimated the amount of profit flowing from the global north, from the global south to the global north. And it never made more than 3 or 4% of the total wage package. And that includes wages and salaries, including for middle managers, supervisors, professionals, et cetera. In fact, what we can and there's significant data that shows that the industries that pay higher wages tend to be industries that are not more monopolized or more concentrated or have higher investments in the global south, but tend to have greater capital intensity. In other words, in each unit per unit output, the cost of what Marx called dead labor, machinery, more materials, et cetera, make up a large percentage of those total costs, and living labor, direct labor input, makes up very little. Thus, in those industries, wages can be, if there's conditions of class organization, class struggle, higher than in industries where it's more labor intensive, where direct wages, living labor makes up a much greater percentage. So there's no empirical basis to argue that either monopolization or imperialist super profits, so-called, are the source of wage differentials. And as I stated before, the pattern we saw in the years leading up to the First World War and the revolutionary wave that swept across the world between 1917 and 1923, where highly paid, relatively skilled industrial workers were in the lead of these struggles and were made up the bulk of the membership of radical parties, continues through the 30s, into the 40s, et cetera. And even if we look at the mass strikes that shook most of the industrialized world between 1965 and 75, and the handfuls of workers who were attracted to the left wings of the socialist and communist movements, these tend to be workers in who are relatively better paid, relatively skilled, and who tend to be concentrated in industries that are fairly capital intensive. So that both as a theory in terms of trying to account for wage differentials, none of this makes sense. And as an explanation of the actual unfolding of class struggle, it makes little sense.
And I'll just tell listeners, I'm going to put in the show notes for this episode a link to the major article where Charlie's developed this analysis, if you want to follow up on some of the points that Charlie's made there. Now, there's a related version of the argument which doesn't look to identify a minority of the workers within imperialist countries as a labor aristocracy, but which says that the entire working class in imperialist countries is a labor aristocracy that could never act in a revolutionary way. Today, for example, you hear a few Maoists that make that kind of argument. Back in the late 60s and the early 70s, groups like the Weather Underground and like-minded radicals elsewhere made this kind of argument. So could you respond a little bit to that version of the argument, which says it's the whole working class in the rich countries that's the labor aristocracy?
Well, I mean, this argument rests on a tendency to, I would think, have an idealized vision of what working class struggle should look like, what the working class should look like at any given time. According to this, if workers are not consistently revolutionary and radical, consistently and explicitly challenging capitalism and imperialism, then they're hopelessly conservative. This tends to also, I would say, not only denigrate the capacities, the potential for radicalism and revolutionary politics among workers in the global north, it also tends to idealize struggles in the global south. I mean, much of this goes along with not only a claim that the working classes defined as waged employees are in the global north are no longer revolutionary. Many of the same theorists will argue the same thing about waged employees in the global south, and instead look to small peasant proprietors as the main force that was going to challenge capitalism, et cetera, and which in the midst of the massive national liberation struggles of the 60s and 70s had some, it looked like it made sense. Now, the problem is they make these arguments at the time that there are then suddenly revolutionary explosions, our near revolutionary explosions in the global north and among the working classes of the global south. So again, between 1965 and 1975, there is a huge uptick in strike activity across the global north and in some countries in the global south. South Africa, which continues into the 80s, Brazil, which continues into the 80s, Mexico, South Korea, etc. And in Europe, this takes the form of a near revolution in France in 1968, a tremendous political instability of capitalism in Italy in the face of massive working class struggles in 1968 and 69. And its highest point in that conjuncture was the Portuguese Revolution, where you actually saw temporarily the collapse of a capitalist state and the formation of what could have become workers' councils, workers and soldiers' councils, which could have posed an alternative democratically organized worker state in these societies. So the idea that they're all bought off is based on, in those early theories, is basically idealizing what workers should be doing without understanding that, in fact, the workings of capitalism, without super profits, without all this other other add-ons, which actually don't make sense, don't actually exist, that you can explain working class passivity, conservatism, reformism, most of the time among most workers in terms of how capitalism works.
And we're going to come back to that later on in this episode. So I think the other thing just worth mentioning, you know, is the way that, you know, it simply isn't the case that poverty correlates with radicalism, right? I think that needs to be said as clearly as possible.
Because I think absolutely.
It's often an assumption that some radicals make.
One quick example on that. The Weathermen and others like them back in the late 60s, early 70s were claiming that, look, it's the most impoverished African Americans who led the ghetto insurrections of the mid 60s. And this led the Black Panther Party at one point took up the idea that the real revolutionary vanguard is what they called the lumpen proletariat, the long-term unemployed, etc. Well, actually, when sociologists looked at who was arrested during these ghetto insurrections, the so-called riots in the summers of 65 and 67, and then after the murder of Dr. King in the spring of 68, they found that overwhelmingly, these were people with jobs, including many people with unionized jobs. There was a very, very high percentage of auto workers arrested for looting, etc., during the ghetto insurrection in Detroit in the summer of 1967. So that even at that time, it was based, as you put it, on this mythology that poverty equals radicalism.
I think if you talk to, you know, revolutionary socialists in India today, for example, across the global south, they would be able to explain to us how you can't look to, you know, the most impoverished and say that this is necessarily going to be the people who are most drawn to the left. Far from it.
They're going to be drawn to they're either going to be passive and demoralized and feel completely powerless because of their social atomization and their poverty, or they can easily be attracted to radical right-wing movements. I mean, the workers who were attracted to the Nazi Party in the early 30s were those who were long-term unemployed. It was not workers who had jobs who were attracted to the right. They were either social democrats or communists. It was the long-term unemployed who can easily be pulled to the right.
Yeah, and while there, of course, are inspiring examples of self-organization amongst, you know, extremely impoverished urban and rural workers in the global South and in other places, I think those points that you make are generally true. Now, let's just circle back here. In the article that you wrote that looks at the theory of the labor aristocracy in detail, you argue that imperialist investment in the global South benefits all workers in the global North. So can you unpack that for listeners about how this happens and to what extent it's the case today?
All right. Well, the way it happens is, and let me just say the way it isn't, and we'll get to this later, is through some sort of mechanism of unequal exchange, some sort of either manipulation of trade or through the transfer of surplus value through the equalization of profit rates. That's not how it happens. It happens through the fact that much of the production of consumer goods, the items that are consumed by workers to reproduce themselves as workers, are increasingly produced in the global South. These goods, whether it be foodstuffs, whether it be clothing, electronics, these tend to be very, very labor-intensive labor processes, production processes, which make it very easy, very amenable to, let's move it to the global South, because we need very low wages to be competitive. If you look at the history of the garment industry, once wages start to rise in the early 20th century in the North, in the Northern US, garment factories move to the US South. As wages there rise, they move to the Caribbean, to Mexico, to East Asia, etc. And we even see in the last 20 years, as wages start to rise in China, it moves to Vietnam, to Cambodia, to other areas where wages are even lower. Now, the result of this is that the value, the cost of these goods falls, which means that which has a contradictory effect. On the one hand, it means that working class living standards for all workers, this is from the most impoverished, undocumented Latino janitor in LA, to a so-called labor aristocrat, you know, a tool and die maker in an auto plant, you know, anywhere in the United States or Canada, benefits from this because it's now they have sources of cheaper food, clothing, electronics, etc. So that, you know, in a period of 30 or 40 years in the 80s, only middle-class professors who could get subsidies from their universities could buy themselves a computer. Now everybody's got a laptop, etc. And it raises their standard of living. At the same time, it reduces the value of their labor power by cheapening the elements of its reproduction, which allows capital in the US to both allow higher capital in the global North to allow higher standards of living but with a greater rate of exploitation. So all working people who live in the global North benefit from cheap consumer goods, which allows them to have a higher standard of consumption. It comes at the cost, it allows also for capital to have a higher rate of exploitation, and thus, which is a counter tendency to falling profits. But yes, that's how everybody in the global North benefits. Now, there are some theorists of the labor aristocracy, who will then say, okay, even the most poorly paid, undocumented immigrant workers now part of the labor aristocracy. But most of them don't. And they can't, because they still have this notion that somehow it's only going to certain sectors of the working class, which is just not a tenable argument.
And I think then the other mistake that people make is, you know, we can say, yes, of course, this is a way in which all workers in the global North and the imperialist countries benefit. But it doesn't mean that there's a net benefit to all workers in the imperialist countries of living in a world with imperialism, right? I think this is the other thing we need to talk about. So could you talk about issues like, you know, other effects that imperialism has? So at the same time as it has this effect on people's living standards, it also does other things which in fact undermine the position of workers in even the richest countries.
Absolutely. The first thing is it does in fact reduce the value of labor power, the amount of human labor, living human labor necessary to reproduce human beings on a day-to-day and intergenerational basis, which allows for a greater rate of exploitation. Imperialism also brings with it not a world in which capital is footloose and fancy free and can close down and move at the whim at whatever workers raise wage, demand higher wages or better conditions, that they can move overnight. That may happen in the garment industry, but it's not happening in the steel industry or auto, et cetera. These are much more capital intensive industries that are not as immobile. But the mere threat of moving work out of the global north is a powerful lever for work, for capital to demand concessions in terms of both work rules and wages and benefits from workers in the global north. Even if they can't actually do it, or at best, what they're going to do is move to a low wage zone within the same country, that is one of the levers they have to force workers to accept declining living standards, worsening working conditions, et cetera. In addition, it is the, in order to maintain an empire, you need to build up a military, which is a huge drain on the possible pot of taxpayer dollars that could go to either guns or butter. In other words, military spending, et cetera, whatever its impact on overall accumulation is, and that's not 100% clear, does mean when military spending goes up, you tend to see cuts in social spending. In the programs that working people fight for and depend on to get through periods of unemployment, low wages, retirement, et cetera. And then finally, in maintaining an empire, not only means spending money on a military as a threat, but it means occasionally wars that will be mostly fought by young working class people. And finally, it means that, this gets back to the first point, it pits imperialism, allows capital to pit one group of workers against another, whether through the threat of moving work to the global south or threatening to bring in immigrants, whatever. This is all ways in which they show that imperialism and the development of a global capitalist, truly global capitalist economy, increases competition amongst workers, which leads to a downward spiral of the conditions of life for workers in all parts of the world economy. I mean, there are various people who are claiming today that, you know, the super exploitation of workers in the global south allows for benefits for workers in the global north. But in fact, all the data shows that that what we're seeing is growing rates of exploitation for all workers in both the global north and global south.
And I would just add as well that, you know, in an imperialist world, as you know, capitalism is, as we've talked about in previous episodes of this podcast, organized capitalism is organized in an imperialist way. Within the imperialist countries, the political dimension of all this serves to try to bind workers to their own exploiters, right?
Exactly.
Fostering people with identification with the flag, the state, and so on, which is all in service of, you know, going off to fight, you know, the Chinese or whoever it might be in the future, right?
Exactly.
Rather than identifying with, you know, working people like us in other parts of the world. So binding people politically to competition with other workers through loyalty to their own states rather than to international solidarity. So there's you've covered some of this, but I'm just going to come at it with another question, because sometimes people might hear of this in a different way, which is the argument, and for example, the anti-capitalist anthropologist Jason Hickel and some of his co-authors have argued this, and so this kind of idea is something that some people on the left have heard about, which is the idea that imperialism, the domination of the South by the North, leads to or involves imperialist countries using their power in the world system to force down the prices of commodities that are produced in the South in various ways. So you've talked already about some of those cheap commodities, but there's an argument that there's kind of an artificial lowering or a supplemental lowering of the prices of those commodities, which then have an effect on the living standards of workers in the North. And so could you kind of comment that version of the argument?
Well, that argument is a variant of an argument that, again, gets introduced into Marxism, first by Kautsky as early as 1903, and then really is presented as the bedrock of a revolutionary socialist analysis, unfortunately, by Lenin and Bukharin, which is the notion of monopoly capitalism. The notion that prior to the 1890s, when Marx was writing about capitalism, he was dealing with what was called competitive capitalism. There were supposedly lots of small firms, all of which were called, economists called price takers. They couldn't set prices. They just took the price the market gave them. And that, you know, in it, and market, you know, prices revolved around the value of the, you know, abstract labor embodied in the commodity. This sees, according to these theorists, all this changes with the development of so-called monopolies. With the concentration and centralization of capital, you get fewer capitals in certain industries. They're bigger. And the implication is they have the power to set prices. And they look at the fact that they do set prices. Corporations do try to set, this is what we want for our commodity. But they think that this is an app, they can do this at will and suppress real competition and suppress the fact that other firms may also set their prices, but they will try to undercut the prices of their competitors. In other words, and the problem with this whole argument is it is based on an idealization of how capitalist competition has always worked. So basically, they adopt not Marx's understanding of competition, which he derives from Smith and Ricardo and the classical economists. They adopt mainstream neoclassical economics theory of competition. In neoclassical economics, which is completely an idealized version of how the so-called market economy should work, whose whole purpose is to show that the market left to its own devices is the most efficient way to allocate resources and make sure that everybody is rewarded for either their labor, their capital, their land, et cetera, and creates a just and wonderful economic system, productive economic system. Now, in their vision, real competition, they have a notion of ideal competition. Small firms, nobody can set prices, all of them have uniform labor processes, et cetera. The problem is, and then any deviation from that is imperfect competition, oligopoly, monopoly, monopsony, all this sort of stuff. The problem is ideal competition never has existed, never will exist, because real competition is fought by capitalists through the use of more and more advanced means of production through fixed capital, which means that there's always going to be some firms that are in a stronger position, others in a weaker position. So the idea that capitalists, these big capitalist corporations, can set prices at will and force producers in the global South to just take them is not historically or empirically accurate. Yes, Walmart can come in and say, we want so many clothes, you know, so many shirts at this price. But Amazon or some other big corporate giant will also come in and say, but we'll pay you a little bit more or a little bit less. This competition continuously goes on, which means that the idea that they can artificially depress prices is not a tenable argument, either theoretically or empirically factual. Instead, the reason that those goods are cheap is because they are produced in labor-intensive work processes in regions where wages are extremely low. Now, that's one version of the unequal exchange argument. There's a more sophisticated version. This goes back to, which basically bases itself on Marx's Capital. In the third volume of Capital, Marx argues that in real capitalist competition, goods are not sold at their value in terms of how much abstract labor there is embodied in that commodity, but by prices of production. Because if it was just value alone, then the profit rates for clothing manufacturers would be higher than the profit rates for steel producers. And so what Marx is arguing is that you get prices of production, which are based on values, the real costs of production, which then mean that through the process of competition, where capital moves between branches of in and out of branches of industry, there is a tendency towards the equalization of profit rates across industries. Now, this process of this very turbulent tendency towards equalization of profit rates means that surplus value produced by labor-intensive firms are appropriated by capitalists in more capital-intensive firms. through this process of competition and price formation. Now, Marx, and probably the most important Marxist economist after Marx's death, Heinrich Grossman, both sort of said, well, maybe there's something about investment in new regions where where wages are low and the investments by imperialist firms are in more labor-intensive industries. Maybe this process leads to a flow of value from the global south to the global north. And this argument is systematized by a Greek Marxist named Aguirre Emanuel in the 1970s. And this is the basis of his labor aristocracy argument, is that all this value is flowing from the global south, which he assumes is uniformly labor-intensive industries, to the global north, which he assumes is uniformly capital-intensive industries. And this provides the basis of the so-called bribe, the higher wages, better working conditions, et cetera. Now, the problem with this argument is that it is the assumption that production processes in the global south have a uniformly lower organic composition of capital, to use Marxist terms, are uniformly more labor-intensive than industries in the global north. And while for the most part that's true, there are significant differences, significant exceptions, particularly since the 1950s in the production of certain key raw materials. Petroleum and gas production have always been highly capital-intensive industries. Mining has become astronomically more capital-intensive since the Second World War. I mean, if you look at the U.S. coal industry, for example, and this is going on even more rapidly in the global south with other minerals, you look at the coal industry in the U.S., it's the number of workers who are coal miners in the U.S. drops substantially through the 1950s, 60s, and 70s into the 80s and 90s, even though the output of coal in the U.S. continues to grow. And that's because they basically introduce machinery. So the problem with the argument is you have industries in the global south, particularly natural resource extraction, whether it's minerals or petroleum, that are as capital intensive, if not more capital intensive, than some industries in the global north. So you, in order to actually make an argument and demonstrate that there's a flow of surplus value of profits from the global south to the global north, through this process of the equalization of profit rates on a world scale, you would have to break it. You'd have to look at different industries. You'd have to break down and disaggregate, as statisticians would disaggregate exports from the global south and exports from the global north into high and low high capital intensive, labor intensive industries. No one has actually done that. The most sophisticated measure of that, of unequal exchange on a world scale, was done by Carschetti and Roberts in a recent issue of Historical Materialism. It was a very, very rigorous article. But the problem is, and they admit it, we are working not with breaking down by industry, but national averages. And of course, on a national average, the capital intensity in the US or Western Europe or Canada or Japan is higher than it is in Brazil or South Africa, no less Laos, Cambodia, or even China. But even they have to admit that in China in particular, industries are becoming more capital intensive, and even their measures of unequal exchange show a fall in the amount of surplus value extracted by the global north from China. So again, it's an argument that there is a version of the unequal exchange argument that makes theoretical sense, that is a theoretical possibility, but no one has actually demonstrated it, because they make an assumption that all the industries are more labor intensive in the global south, more capital intensive in the global north.
Right. That's helpful. And I think it's now time to move on to talk about how we should explain some of the things that people often go about trying to explain with this unhelpful notion of labor aristocracy and some of these related ideas, right? So if the explanations we've been discussing so far are really flawed, how should we explain why working class people so often respond to capitalism, not by committing to radical or revolutionary politics, but by more or less accepting the status quo, or somewhat better than that, trying to work for reforms within the framework of capitalism, in other words, endorsing reformist politics?
Okay. The way we explain it is by starting with a non-vulgar materialist explanation of working class consciousness. The vulgar explanation is, if workers are paid well, they're fat and happy, and they're bought off with TV sets, you know, color TVs and six packs of beer, etc. And when they're poor and impoverished, they're going to be revolutionary. That's actually not true, as we've already established. A non-vulgar materialist analysis links working class consciousness to working class activity and struggle and organization. In other words, and this is a point that Luxemburg understood better than any other Marxist prior to the First World War, that the working class, or at least significant minorities of the working class, will develop radical and revolutionary ideas when they act collectively as a class in struggle against capital, whether it's their employers or the state, and where they engage in struggles that challenge the authority of either their employer or the state. That is, in the context of these struggles, that they have to build broader and broader solidarity amongst each other and try to overcome the divisions that exist among workers that are rooted in capitalist social relations. We'll get to that in a minute. They have to overcome racism, sexism, xenophobia, etc. And they have to confront their employer and the state as their enemies. And as they experience themselves as a collective agent of radical change, especially when they can win concrete victories through mass struggle, this creates the basis of working class radicalism and the openness to revolutionary politics. Now, once you have a non-vulgar materialist conception of consciousness, then you can understand why most of the time most workers are not revolutionaries. And that has to do with the basic realities of capitalist social property relations. What makes capitalism, one of the things that makes capitalism capitalism is that both capitalists and workers, in order to reproduce themselves, have to compete in the marketplace. Capitalists compete with other capitalists for market share, and workers compete for jobs. And the reason workers have to compete for jobs is that we are propertyless, in the sense not that we don't own a home or a car or, you know, electronic gadgets, but that we do not own means of production that would allow us to produce our own conditions of existence, our own subsistence outside of the wage relationship, which means that workers can only be engaged in mass disruptive struggles, which usually involve, at their height, the mass withholding of work, of labor, only episodically. Because the reality is, when you're on strike, you're getting either not paid at all, or you're getting your strike benefits are significantly less than what you're used to, and you can't do this all the time. Otherwise, you will starve to death, or you will experience, as the sociologists would put it, downward social mobility. You'd experience some level of impoverization, which means that working class struggle, particularly militant, solidaristic, and disruptive, i.e. illegal struggles, are always episodic. You get these big upsurges, and out of that, and then you win a big victory. Most people at that point are going to go back to the hard, difficult, alienating work of just reproducing themselves and their households, showing up to work 8 to 10 hours a day, doing usually routine, repetitive, meaningless work under the supervision of complete idiots, petty despots and idiots. You get out of work and then you spend your time trying to make sure your household members are okay and try to just, you know, be able to make sure that, you know, there's a roof over your head, there's food on the table, if you have children, that they're doing okay in school, whatever. I mean, this is what consumes most people's lives. It's not that they're indifferent or apathetic. They're just consumed by the daily grind of reproducing themselves, which has gotten even worse in the last 40 years with neoliberal austerity and the withdrawal of any minor social supports for that reproduction of working class households. Okay, so most people are just going to go back, you know, are going to, for the most part, unless they're compelled to, they're going to go back to daily life. And what they want is for somebody else to make sure that things don't get any worse and maybe get a little bit better. And it's not because they don't, it's because they don't believe, based on their lived experience, that they can be struggling all the time and that they could do anything else. So they look to the minority of people who remain active. Now, most of the people who remain active don't become full-time officials of the organizations that are created in these upsurges. They remain workplace or community or social movement activists who are trying between the big upsurges to carry on the struggle. They're the ones who will organize fights at the workplace over speed up. They're the ones who will, you know, after a big anti-racist mobilization, continue to picket around discriminatory housing or another outrageous police murder, et cetera. Those folks are the ones who generally were historically, this is a much broader layer, and were historically the social audience for radical and revolutionary ideas. They were always a minority of the class. Then you have a small part of that minority who become full-time officials of trade unions, social movement organizations, especially as they become nonprofits, et cetera, or it's, you know, in many cases, the political parties that claim to speak in the name of the work of working people. Now, these folks, their conditions of life have radically changed. The worker who becomes a full-time trade union official is engaged in constant negotiating between the people they represent and the employer, and their conditions of life are very different. Even if they're not paid more than the people they represent, which is not the case in the U.S. They're always paid a fuck of a lot more than the people they represent. Even if they're not, their conditions of life have become more like middle-class professionals. They can set their own hours. They do meaningful work. They're not producing crap on an assembly line or in an office. They're negotiating benefits. They're solving problems. They're, you know, they're doing all this work. It is much more meaningful. It involves much more of a unity between mental work and manual work, between conception and execution, as Harry Braven would have put it. For these people, then, they want to make sure the idea of going back to just being a wage worker is something they want to avoid. And thus, they tend to look at whatever organizations are created, not as instruments for struggle, but as an end in itself, as the institutional basis of this particular lifestyle. And they're the ones who will push for substitutes for militancy and disruption. They're the ones who will go for routine bargaining, a grievance procedure, parliamentary maneuvering to win reforms, et cetera. And in this, most of the time, they will have the support of what is the mass of workers who appear to be, quote, passive, but are basically spending most of their time and energy just trying to get by. Now, Robert Brenner basically describes the reformism of the officialdom as unconditional. They can never abandon this because that would mean endangering their conditions of life. Reformism for the bulk of workers is, in a sense, conditional. As long as it produces real results for them, then they'll go along with it. You know, as long as wages are rising and working conditions are not getting too bad, et cetera, they'll go along with it. When that breaks down, one of two things happens. One, if there's a significant layer of activists in their workplace and community, et cetera, who have maintained radical or revolutionary politics and an independent organization, they'll engage, these people can be brought into new waves of struggle. Or if that layer is weak and can't lead successful struggles, and their leaders who are wedded to reformist politics are no longer able to produce reforms, which is what we have seen very consistently over the last 40 or 50 years, starting with the crisis of the late 60s, early 70s, the reformists and their methods can't even defend what we've got. As that breaks down and there's not an alternative, nobody sees, there's not a significant layer of people who are saying we can fight and win if we fight differently, these workers could easily be drawn from reformism into being attracted to reactionary ideas. Because if they see that militancy is not on the agenda and the routine reformism of their union leaders or NGO leaders or their party leaders is producing nothing but concessions, then they're going to try to get ahead at the expense of other workers. Because remember, under capitalism, the working class is not only a collective producer with a potential common interest in the socialization of production and the remaking of society, they're also individualized and segmented sellers of labor power who are competing with other workers. And when struggle seems unrealistic, you know, getting ahead at the expense of other workers seems like a safe way to defend yourself. Now, of course, in the medium to long term, it's a trap. It's a chump's game, as our British comrades would put it. But it seems to be a viable option. Now, as people do this, they begin to develop ideas that justify that action, those actions. So if I'm trying to get ahead at the expense of black and brown workers, I develop racist ideas. If I try to get ahead at the expense of immigrants, I become xenophobic. If I try to get ahead at the expense of women workers or queer workers, I become sexist and homophobic and transphobic, etc. So the reality is, the sort of basic point of this is, under capitalism, only a minority of the working class is going to be active and potentially radical at any given time. And to expect that all workers at all times are, you know, chomping at the bit to go after their bosses in the States is completely idealist. Thus, we can explain reformism and even working class conservatism, the extraction of minorities of workers to the right, not through bribes from imperialism or any of this sort of thing, but by the workings of capitalism itself. And that the counter to this is not their impoverization, but through the redevelopment of working class, independent working class struggle and organization, the development of what Alan Sears has called infrastructures of dissent, that allow for the reemergence of a layer of workers who are looking for ways to constantly fight. What, you know, the British called a militant minority, and what the classical Marxists actually meant by the working class vanguard.
Right. So this is an alternative to the unfortunate notion that is still out there that somehow the working class is inherently revolutionary, and then everything else that isn't revolutionary action has to be explained as a deviation from this essence.
Exactly.
You know, which is, I think, is a, unfortunately, this default idea of a way of thinking that's still there on the far left.
Yeah, it's interesting because it combines a completely idealist notion of consciousness with vulgar materialist notions of consciousness. Workers should be, in our ideal world, always revolutionary, but when they're not, they're simply bought off.
Unity of opposites. So
yeah, something like that.
You know, just to wrap up then, you know, it's pretty clear that hoping or looking to social revolution to solve the problems that we face is a very uncommon response for workers most of the time. So then the question is, does this mean then that revolutionary socialism, which looks to the working class to transform society, is not a viable political project? How do we respond to that challenge?
The way I respond is this. Capitalism cannot be reformed. Capitalism continues to reproduce itself and survive. The continued existence of our species is in severe danger. I mean, you've written on this, David. Basically, capitalism is destroying the biological material basis for the survival of our species. Not for all life on the planet. There'll be cockroaches. But this species of sentient mammals will not survive. The only social force that has the potential power and interest to replace it is the working class. Now, whether that is a likely outcome or not, I haven't believed that the revolution was imminent in a real sense, at least since 1978 or 79. But I also realize that there is, that the potential is there. Workers will struggle. New militant minorities will emerge. And the role of socialists and revolutionary socialists is to be part of that process. Now, we may not be able to pull this together in time to save the species, but I don't see any other alternative out there that is at all realistic. I mean, we have seen that capitalism, undeterred, is basically pushing humanity to disaster. Reformism, in all of its manifestations, has been an absolute disaster and has not been able to stem this tide. The only thing that does is workers' struggles, which continue to exist. We're still under capitalism, and workers will fight. I'm a little bit more optimistic today than I was 5 years ago, because we have seen significant upticks in struggle producing new layers of militants, whether that be outside the workplace, like the successive wave of anti-racist struggles under Black Lives Matter, or whether it has been, and I think this is crucially important, the new or the mass outrage at the Zionist genocide in Gaza, or even more for me, crucially important, is the revival of workplace struggles, that we have seen a small but significant uptick in strike activity in the last 3 or 4 years. All of this points to the possibility. Now, what we need is a left that sees its task as being part of those struggles of building independent organization, rebuilding these infrastructures of dissent, rebuilding a militant minority, and doesn't see the solution as let's get some good person elected to office, whether it's in the head of a union or no less in the capitalist state. So yes, I think revolutionary socialists have to be extremely sober and not tell people who are new to politics that the revolution's around the corner and we're going to win. What we have to say is this is the only possible path. There are opportunities and we need to be there.
And I'll just end tying it back to what we were talking about for most of this episode with a line from the Egyptian socialist Hassan al-Hamawawi, who has written that it's foolish to dismiss the working class in the West because my liberation as someone in the global South will never be achieved unless power falls away from the global North. So whether it's North or South, working class power is ultimately the only way out.
I cannot agree more.
That's it for this episode of Victor's Children. I'd like to thank Jonathan Croker, the producer of Victor's Children, without whom the podcast wouldn't be possible. I'd also like to thank Posey Legg, who designed the graphic for Victor's Children. If you found the episode worth listening to, please do tell other people about the show, since word-of-mouth recommendations are especially helpful. If you don't subscribe through your preferred podcast app, please do. And while you're there, please give the show a high rating. It helps to promote us. If you have a suggestion for an episode or some other kind of constructive feedback, feel free to be in touch with me. You can contact me through victorschildren@gmail.com.